Good morning. Thanks for joining us, John. This is an interesting topic, green chemistry. First of all, I want to mention John Warner. He's the director of the Center for Green Chemistry and a professor and actually a very interesting person overall, but we'll find out about John shortly. I wanted to mention that I always try to do a little background check on the guests and the topic, of course. And I looked on the UML site and found a kind of neat quote here. Here we go. As one of the creators of green chemistry, Professor John Warner has received his share of...
Want to go to industry, and instead of saying, don't do this, don't do this, they want to go to industry and say, why don't you do this instead? And so they focus on a type of molecule, a type of material, and try to invent that safer alternative. And like I said, it's not an easy thing to do. I think it would be amazing if one student in their, you know, 4-year academic career could do that. If it was that easy, we would be in pretty good shape.
Right.
The fact is that we don't know how to make most of these molecules safely. We have no idea. We have to invent new mechanisms. We have to invent new materials that don't cause environmental harm.
Right. And I suppose an example of breadth of work involved in this system. If it were so easy, we have a cure for cancer, for instance, 100%. And in fact, all of these things take years and years and years. And I knew this was really just matter, especially losing my voice. Now, about our students, we talked a little bit about this often. Where do they tend to come from so that they arrive at green chemistry?
I think that many of the students are interested in the environment. You know, like most students, they want to save the world. They want to make a difference. They want to make a positive impact. And I think a lot of them initially are attracted to environmental sciences and that type of a career. And what happens is, you know, this is a very important career. We need to have environmental scientists. They measure ozone depletion. They measure global warming. They measure water pollution. And that's an important part of the whole pollution prevention thing.
Mm-hmm.
But measuring isn't the same as coming up with an alternative that might perhaps solve the problem. And that's where my students are coming in. They want to actually make something that leads to the solution to the problem, as opposed to measuring it and identifying it and creating policy to get around it. Their idea is to create materials to get around it.
You must be proud of them. I can see it as you speak, John. Well, let's see. So, what industry needs to make safer products and even have safer production practices is to be provided with alternatives, clean alternatives. Do you feel that it would be useful for teams, for instance, of academics and state economists to sort of march in the industry and say, look, this is what we have existing, and this is what is going to save you money, this will help create new revenue for you. Are there folks like that too, especially, you know, studying from UMass more specifically, folks that
are aware of the existing green chemistry alternatives?
Well, again, the point is that I honestly do believe that if you have an alternative that is just as expensive or inexpensive as the non-safe alternative, and it does the job that the non-safe alternative does, industry will embrace it in a heartbeat. Now, obviously, the expenses that are incurred when they use hazardous materials make it very, very difficult to do business, and so they would love to have the alternative. So I don't think this is an issue of convincing industry. Industry would do this in a heartbeat. The problem is that the alternatives don't exist, and so I don't think it's going to industry and saying, you got to do this. I think it's going to industry and saying, here are the solutions. So then the question becomes, who is in the position to create these alternatives and give them to industry, and that's academia.
Right. Well, what we're thinking about education now, and that is you are, but I'm always thinking about that gap. There are existing alternatives now, and there's a gap between the existence, I suppose, or some gap with the existence of green chemicals, and industry would know about that. I mean, it takes someone, for instance, a manufacturer of tires, for instance. I mean, they've been doing this for decades and decades and decades. The processes of production are embedded, and it requires a lot of bandwidth to make changes and to certainly find out about innovation outside of that facility. Is that also something that you're involved with, or is there something going on in that campus that sort of, lessens that gap, mitigates that?
Well, look at it this way. If an industry has been existing for 20 or 30 years, then they have a technology that they've been practicing. If they are using materials that are hazardous, the way our economy is based, they can't just scrap the factory and rebuild a new factory. The technology has to be invented that drops into their existing practice. Mm-hmm. What isn't happening is no one is working to invent those drop-in technologies. And so that's where the issue comes, is that essentially in industry, this is the, I got my undergraduate degree and my doctorate degree in chemistry. In the United States, there are no graduate programs in chemistry or in material science, for that matter, that require any knowledge of toxicity or environmental impact. It is not part of our training of scientists, people who are making materials and going to work in industry. There's not one component that prepares them to make things environmentally benign, to make things safe. So once they're in industry and they've got their job, it's too late. Their job is to do whatever the industry is having them do, and they don't have the skills. So what green chemistry is saying is we have to train the next generation of chemists to do everything that the chemists do today, every single thing, take nothing out of the rigor of the discipline, but add to it a knowledge of toxicological mechanisms, a knowledge of environmental impact, and so add on top of their education these very things so that they can look at a process, and if they have to make a red dye that has a certain color and doesn't fade in the light and sticks to a fabric, they also have to make it so it's not carcinogen, that it doesn't cause birth defects. Right now, we have no idea how to do that. So it's not that we don't want to do it.
Right.
We have no idea how to do that. And so what green chemistry is trying to change the education process to make that just as important as the color, as important as the safety, as important as the all these different things all come together.
Right. That's interesting. And actually, it sounds much like the perspective of sustainable development and ours on the long view is this idea that everything being created, developed, maintained, whatever it is, a park, a building, a car, that its creation is informed by sustainable development. So that's always in the background, and that sounds like what needs to become necessary in academia too, whether we're training engineers or scientists.
Absolutely. The idea is to find out why it's not happening and figure out how you can catalyze the change so it spontaneously happens. Really interesting example is if I went to a group of high school students, if I went to a group of elementary school students, if I went to a group of faculty, if I went to any group and I held a glass of water. And I said, remember back when you had science in school and you learned about different properties and things like that? Let's describe this glass of water. Someone would say it's a liquid. Someone would say that it's colorless. Someone would say it boils at 100 degrees. Someone would say it freezes at zero. We're running out of the easy stuff, but we all know what it means to describe a material. In our society today, it's unlikely someone's going to say it's not toxic. No one's going to say it has negligible environmental impact. We have this weird relationship with materials that toxicity, environmental impact, is something else. It's not a fundamental description of a material. And so green chemistry's job is to change education all the way down to kindergarten classes that our relationship with materials just includes those two things, toxicity, environmental impact. If we can make that wholesale change, then when a scientist working at a company is inventing a red dye, it'll be on the top of their mind that another property is toxicity, environmental impact. It isn't happening now.
Do you see that happening by your knowledge of time? Do you know if, for instance, elementary school and junior and high school science teachers, for instance, are thinking in those terms more? Is there any evidence of that we're going to be progressing?
Well, it's again part of the green chemistry program. One of the things that every graduate student, every postdoc, every researcher at UMass Lowell working in the Center for Green Chemistry goes at least once a month to a K-12 school or a community group and talks about their research, goes into the class, develops a hands-on thing, and communicates with the general public about what it is we're trying to do to make those changes ourselves. Instead of sitting back and waiting for textbooks to be written and curriculum to be created, we're saying, well, someone's got to do it, and so it's part of just who we are, and I assume that as students graduate from the program, they will forever see this as part of their job as a scientist to be communicating and having a two-way conversation with the general public. One of the problems that I believe we have is this whole overwhelming problem with science literacy. I feel that people in the public have a right and a responsibility to recognize their relationship with materials, that it's not that difficult, that they can truly understand what a chemist does and should not allow it to go on behind closed doors, that science development and research is not something that should be cut off from the general population. The general population should be knowledgeable and participate in that process instead of waiting until the end when all of a sudden they have
a... Right, the products are what you can do.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they do make decisions on what products they buy. They make decisions on what politicians they vote for. If some of the science literacy is part of the decision-making process, then perhaps we can steer education in the right direction.
You've brought something to mind. I understand, and you'll have to explain this to me because I missed that seminar. You did a seminar relating creativity to the sciences. Can you tell us your perspective on that integration?
Well, again, this is just me speaking. I'm certainly not knowledgeable on this subject, but I think a lot about it. I believe that the word art and the word science is a human creation, and it's something that we use to partition knowledge. But when we bring something into existence, when we imagine something and then we create something, the word art, the word science has nothing to do with it. If I had some neurological experiment, someone hooked up a bunch of electrodes to me somehow, and I sat down and composed a piece of music on the piano, and then I went into the lab and started to design a polymer to do something in industry, I am certain the exact same neurons are firing, the exact same process when I create something, whether it's music or chemistry, it's the same thing.
Right, and when we talk about neurons, we're talking about the synapses in our brains, the way that our brains are firing, fusing, processing.
And so how many times do you know a four-year-old child says, I'm not good in math, I'm very creative, I'm going to be an artist, or some poor soul that's good in science or good in math, they're not tracked. We track people in elementary school. By the time they're 8 years old, they've already decided they're a scientist, they're an artist, and I think that's a big problem, because we need to realize that if we continue to do things the way we always do, we'll always get the same product. We need to attract into science a whole new set of eyes, a whole new set of ideas, and so we need to address this idea of creativity and bring a whole new creative outlook into making materials.
Yeah,
so
that's really interesting. That's so true. I think I probably earlier on thought of myself as an artist, not necessarily a musician. But as time goes past and I've myself gotten really interested in the environment, for sure, I think we can be both very much the math and the artist. Are there policies that, when we talk about the, making impact to society and the whole community, that's why we're so to us. And if we want to make an impact, we need to pay attention to policy, government policy, and who we ought to vote for, and who we ought to call and contact to impact positive change, to have this awareness of that, right?
Yeah.
So,
There's a few things at the state level. There's a piece of legislation. There's things going on to develop the BioNano Green Center at UMass Lowell. The House and the Senate in Massachusetts are working on that. That's a very important thing to help us go forward. And in the federal government, there's the Green Chemistry Research and Development Act that is currently in the Senate floor that's been sponsored by Senator Olympia Snowe. Both of those things.
The opportunity to say that the American Foundation and all of our campuses go to www.wuml-longview.org, and they're so good as www.wuml-longview.org, and that is the Longview website, and it has a lot of information, links and tools, reflections, all sorts of different things, and hopefully I'm always recommending that.
Thank you.